Welcome along to another D Word podcast where we talk dementia. Have you ever thought that we need a new way of dealing with the increasing number of dementia cases throughout the world? Well, so is my guest this week, Mary Fridley. Mary is coordinator for the group Reimagining Dementia, a creative coalition for justice. Well, Mary, it's great to have you as my guest here on the D Word. It's lots to talk about. Before we get into all that, just give me a little bit of background and how your interest in dementia as a subject came about.
Sure. Well, thank you first for having me. I'm thrilled. And I've heard nothing but very good things about you and your show. So I'm very honored to be here. I'm only hesitating because when Susan Massad, who was my very good friend and colleague and physician, and I first, we were the two people who found that our first foray into the dementia conversation was through a workshop and conversation series that I continued to lead called The Joy of Dementia, You Gotta Be Kidding. And that came about 7 years ago. However, Susan and I could never remember why we decided to take the plunge with dementia, in the sense that my mom passed away from late stage dementia, and that was years later. Although it taught me a lot, I think it certainly further humanized the experience for me, and as did Susan's sister. And now, I have friends who are going through it, and I anticipate many more given my age and all that. However, 7 or 8 years ago, it wasn't a big part of my life. I will not pretend. However, Susan and I had been co-leading a number of workshops that bring, and I'll say a little bit more about this later. It's going to sound a little strange, but the approach that we use utilizes play, and particularly improvisational play and performance, and kind of supporting people to kind of exercise, rediscover our very ordinary creativity, that human beings are infinitely more creative than we're ever, and particularly adults, are ever see ourselves as. And the number of these workshops touched on subjects concerning aging, including death and dying. So I'm guessing dementia probably it was in that moment where perhaps we were approached or just began to read more about it. But however it happened, when we first read kind of the official, if you will, the official language and writings and whatever about dementia, quite honestly, we were just appalled. I mean, there's just some, I would love to, but it was appalling. And in our view, the biomedical model, which, you know, is so overdetermines, well, it overdetermines much in our life, but it certainly overdetermines how we see and understand and relate to dementia, was simply inadequate. And furthermore, and this is my opinion, I'm not asking everyone to agree, I think it's incredibly harmful. And it's been incredibly harmful because it misunderstands who human beings are. It mislocates what disease is. And it has no capacity to, I think, support particularly people for whom the medical profession has pretty much said, we can't do much for you. And they can. And that's, you know, and people have all kinds of opinions about that. I'm not entering the fray particularly about the emphasis on cure that continues, although I think that's beginning to be pushed back on a bit. In the sense that, and I was speaking to one of our members living with dementia, I'm also the coordinator of Reimagining Dementia, a creative coalition for justice, which again, we can chat a little bit more about, which has about 1,000 members in about 44 countries around the world. So I was speaking to one of them, and we were talking about cure, and she said, and again, I think I mentioned she lives with dementia. She said, well, in my mind, what we're doing is the cure. Because right now, what people living with dementia and all of us need to do is radically transform how dementia is, how we perform dementia, how we relate to it, how we see it in our broader culture. That it's just not designed to help people live. And I know people often talk about living meaningful lives, meaningful lives, and I support that. That's a lot of what my work is about. However, I think that's very hard to come by. So I think I think our understanding of cure needs to be broadened more dramatically, and I think infused with infinitely more creativity. So that's a little bit, and so that's my dementia life. Both Joy of Dementia and Reimagining Dementia are projects that I'm passionate about. And again, we can say a little bit more about them. But the only other thing that I would say relative to introducing myself to your listeners is I really, in a way, what set me up for this was 40 years as a community organizer and social change advocate. And someone who I was trained in the approach that we use in the Joy of Dementia. So everything that I've done over the last 40 years with colleagues and friends around the world is to infuse play and helping people create their lives with others so that we have more responsibility for the kind of lives that we're living. But also in our experience, it allows people to live far more joyously, far more growthfully. So we wanted to bring that to, and I'm very passionate about bringing that to every area of the world. But certainly dementia, I think, is in particular need.
Yeah, I think, you know, we I think, entered probably around about the same time. In 2016, I joined the Alzheimer's Society. Uh-huh. Here in the UK, and I immediately began to think that there's something not quite right with you know, the way all this works. Couldn't quite put my finger on it, and so the whole concept of reimagining dementia, if we can come on that, I think is a great title, because for all my years I used to work in public health, and I heard people talking about diabetes, coronary heart disease, etc., etc., and not once did I hear someone talk about dementia. And when I actually got involved, I thought, well, wait a minute, isn't this the biggest public health issue we face? But nobody's talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've managed to, and in a way, and part of this, I come from the LGBTQ community, so this is and not everyone will use this phrase, but I kind of think about it, and again, some friends and I were talking about this the other day, that I think dementia remains far too much in the closet. And we are the people responsible for keeping it there. And by we, I mean the broader culture. I'm not talking about every single individual, although, and I agree with you. The coalition launched a campaign in September called Taking It to the Streets. And really, it was designed, and this is maybe a simple-minded way of thinking about it, but really, the reason we thought, okay, let's go with this, is because of how that dementia continues to be surrounded by what we call a cone of silence, which contributes so much to this shame and stigma and isolation. Even though, as to your point, this is not an exotic disease that affects five people. Hundreds of millions are literally infected, either they're living with it or caring for someone. But it also permeates our culture. I mean, I didn't have dementia in my life before 7 or 8 years ago. But if the conversation had ever, well, one, it's telling that I didn't ever think about it either. But if somebody had, if we just started talking about dementia, I'm sure I would have had the same response as everyone else, because you're afraid of it. it's almost immediately fearful. So that's a pretty heavy duty impact.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the D-Word podcast with my guest, Mary Fridley from Reimagining Dementia.
And, I've talked to friends living with dementia, and one of them, probably a couple of weeks ago, actually, said to me, well, I really resonate with the D-Word concept. Because he said, when I got my diagnosis, all those D-words were the word don't. Don't drive, don't do this, don't do that, don't
exactly.
do the other.
And exactly.
he said nobody used the D-word, which was do. And that, again, seems to be something that, you were saying earlier, the medical model kind of takes you down the route of, well, you can't do all this anymore.
I agree. And it's rather arrogant on their part. And I generally kind of think they are a bit arrogant, because basically what they're saying is, because we can't help you, you shouldn't live. I mean, or we're going to declare it, just a disaster. Well, that's convenient. And real live human beings like you and so many others still have to live. And we're still part of the world. And we're still, doing all the things that we do. And yet that moment of diagnosis changes everything. How you're seen, how you're related to. But I agree. I think it's again, and I try to be a kind of cool, hip, yeah. But I can't tell you how shocked I've been at just the stories we hear, just common, and I've been at this now for about 7 years, so I've heard a lot of stories, and it's shocking to me. It's just shockingly inhumane, and I understand why it happens. I'm not naive. I know the world that we live in, and there's some very real reasons why I think cognitive decline raises particular concerns in a culture that's obsessed with, if you will, our brains.
Sure. When you're talking about the joy of dementia, do you think when we become adults, we lose that ability to, perhaps be a bit silly, play and those
yes.
kind of things, because we suddenly become kind of socially constrained?
Yes. Yes and yes and a definitive yes. And again, now I'll say our work at the Eastside Institute, where I am on faculty and where Joy of Dementia is posted. Our work was heavily influenced by a early Soviet psychologist by the name of Lev Vygotsky. Now, I'm guessing many readers don't know of him, which is too bad, because we all should. So maybe this will create an outpouring of Google searches for Lev Vygotsky. But the importance of his work, because he was a he as a psychologist was, came through the Russian Revolution. And forget for a moment how people feel about that. I'm not raising that. It's more that regardless of how you feel, this is a very, very large, massive country that suddenly had to learn how to run itself. That it had been under authoritarian rule and they were underdeveloped. Their people didn't have what they needed to suddenly take this country and go forward. And so he spent a lot of his time exploring the relationship between learning and development. How do we grow? How do we help others grow? And the nub of it, and this is coming back to the point you just made, is that how we all learn as babies is very different than what learning is understood to be now. Because, you've been around babies, you've been a baby, we all have been around babies. And babies go, oh, ba, da, ba, 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 da, whatever they say. And we as adults or language speakers, for the most part, don't say to them, that's not talking. You don't know how to talk. Go away, find a dictionary. don't come back till you know how to talk. That would be ludicrous. And I think even most of us would say if you did that, it's kind of cruel. We give them complete freedom to play, to pretend, and encourage and relate to them as speakers of the language, ahead of themselves, even though they're not. So, you know, if I go, ba, 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 you're and other language speakers and adults would go, oh, yeah, mommy will be home soon, or yes, we want your, yeah. Like, it's not, and that's accepted. That's a rich environment. They can fail. They can pretend. They imagine. They play. And that's how they learn to speak. They imitate. And they're always hearing. And they're being related to far more advanced than they in fact are. When that shifts in our view, and that's wonderful, because none of us would be here if that wasn't true. However, and this comes to your point, at about age 6, or roughly when we enter the school system, that support for play pretty much ends. The whole learning model changes. It becomes far more individualistic. But more broadly socially, it also becomes now about growing up, becoming an adult, being responsible, knowing who you are, you know. And knowing is central to that. And you become a knower. And the higher on the knowing capacity level you are, you know, you're considered, I think, an advanced human being. So to me, that the ways that we relate babies and young children and that rich environment that we create around them, in a way, our challenge over the years, and I think, again, is particularly relevant to the dementia world, is try to create those environments around adults, which isn't the same as treating adults like children. I think adults, but we can have that spirit. And we can certainly, so how do you do that with adults? Because yes, as adults, we bring in a lot of baggage. And a lot of that baggage is produced, to your point, is because we've stopped playing. We've stopped playing around. We've stopped all the things that you said. And that, so I don't want to sound unduly serious, but I think that's a serious issue. Because then when you, and life is full of uncertainty. I mean, and if you look at our world now, and certainly dementia, that the reason I think it's, I mean, there are a multitude of reasons why I think it constrains our ability to navigate life and create our lives more joyfully. But it doesn't put us in a good position to handle uncertainty or things that are unknown or unknowable. And much of our world now is unknown, unknowable, uncertain. And that's what dementia is. I'm sorry, I'm not, I know there are many different kinds of dementias. I'm not, and that's important. However, the experience, and I know I experienced this with my mom, and I'm sure you're very familiar with it. It turns your world upside down because all that you once, quote, knew is now been, you're becoming something else. And we're not adequately, and unfortunately, I think what we're far better in is trying to control things than we are in trying to create something new together. And by something new, I don't mean big. I mean, we can create this. I mean, in a way, human beings created the world. We created everything in your desk and in your office and my office. I mean, we're a pretty creative species. However, I just think I'm talking about creativity in very ordinary ways of just being able to take what's available to us and do something new and different with it. That's what I mean by that's we have to continue growing and developing. So in a way, our job, and I think both the Joy of Dementia and the Institute's work, as well as Reimagining Dementia, is working hard to try to give us some new tools to do that and taking seriously If you need to create new ways of going forward, you just can't keep repurposing the old ways. Like at some point, we're going to accept that challenge that, hey, and I think this is absolutely, and I will state this unequivocally. I'm happy if people disagree with me. That's great. I think dementia demands something entirely new. And for us, that's the joy of dementia and the importance of reimagining, to your point.
Yeah, I do, you know, it's you do what you've always done, you'll get what you've always got. And yeah. I very much felt that in terms of, now you're voluntary and you're independently funded,
yes. Yeah.
Which I guess is very important, because what I found is in part of a large organisation, it is mm-hmm. very, very difficult to be creative and to think yes. outside the box.
Exactly. It is, and there are a number of reasons. And I don't think it's because all those places don't have creative people. It's not that. I think it gets stunted, and it's just not environmentally part of the mix. But also, you know, and so for me, too, I mean, I make my living as a nonprofit fundraiser. So I know a lot about the NGO nonprofit world. And I also think we're severely limited by how funding works, and particularly how funding from the government or even large foundations work. And I'm not knocking it. This is not a criticism of people who receive money. I live in this world. However, let's not kid ourselves that if that's the funding that you're reliant on, then of course your work's going to get shaped by those priorities and what they feel is acceptable. And I know from personal experience that, you know, people say, "Well, no, you're going too far. Can't do that." But they won't even entertain new kinds of things, particularly things that aren't, quote, scientifically, you know, proven. But that becomes a bit of a bind from an evaluative vantage point, because if it's evaluatable by the existing tools, then how new can it be? And again, I'm not saying that as a purist, but I think we could at least entertain, hey, maybe we not need to decide some completely different evaluating tools and lenses so that to support something actually emerging. And I think it's the emergence of life that we're trying to support. And I think, and for us, and again, that was our decision, but a decision that I carried into the coalition, which is we're going to remain financially independent so we can do whatever we want. And we can be as radical as we want. We can be as humanistic as we want. We can cross boundaries. And, you know, we don't have to do things in a particular way. So it's not that we're not, there's a billion constraints, including constraints we all bring to the table. We're all social products. There's nothing special per se. And that's why I feel so strongly about the importance of creating environments in which people can genuinely do something new, or at least take risks to do what they don't know how to do. And even if it's that, and I don't know if this is going to be visual or just audio, but I'm holding my fingers very closely together. If we can only move people this much, that's fine. I mean, I'm all for revolutions, but that's, I think we're so far from that in the most common sense of that. But I think we can create revolutions in our lives every day with others.
Yeah, I've done over 200 shows now. And I can think of all the people I've spoken to, and they would probably all 100% agree with what you're saying terms of the fact that not only for people living with dementia, but as you said, for their carers, their family members, their friends. Yeah. I think you used the phrase earlier, it turns the world upside down, which it does. I think the only frustration with people is we seem here, you know, I don't know as much obviously about the States as I do here in the UK, but in the UK we have a number of large organisations that seem occasionally to sit in their little silos, try and get their own funds, and you suddenly, you know, just want to get hold of them and say, look, can't we all work together on this?
You know, it's funny you said that. I did another podcast a couple months ago, and the host asked, he kind of said, and then asked me the same thing, his question, why don't we work more together? Now, we could have a whole conversation about that. I think, again, part of it, I think, does come back to funding. And people aren't funded to work together. So again, for me, it's another argument for independence. However, it's not, I mean, I'm not trying to proselytize. It's just funding is very narrow and very specific. I mean, there are a lot of other reasons. I don't know that there's ever been this long tradition of me, you know, but, and I think that's part of why I'm very proud of the coalition. I think that's also breaking up some. I do think that we're beginning to see a definite shift in how all this and dementia as a whole is being related to. And that's, I can see that even in just the little time that I've been involved. And I don't want to make things sound like, oh, wow. But again, coming from an organizing background, but I also think it's helpful for us to, as human beings, you've got to be able to read the nuances and the changes, because they're not going to be like, it's not going to be tomorrow. We're both going to wake up and, you know, the attitude toward dementia will suddenly be far more accepting and positive and growthful and blah, blah, blah. But that doesn't mean that we don't push forward. And again, I think the coalition was founded because we wanted to have, in a way, a visible unit, a visible place where people who were interested in being more creative, being more humanistic, being more radical, working outside the box, whatever that is, using the arts, one would have a home and could support each other, since so much of our work happens in silos. But also that we have a place now that the world can see. Because I think one of the reasons why the biomedical / cure wing about Alzheimer's, and again, I'm going to stay neutral for the moment about that, but I do think one of the reasons that they're dominant is because they're what people can see. I mean, I know you have large, and well, human beings can see that. They can't see creativity for the most part. They can't see the work that I'm doing or your podcast or the work that's being done in Africa or what Pio Canto, some remarkable researcher, is doing in Toronto, whatever. So my personal goal and what I think is necessary is for us to be as big and as visible as possible, because people need to see us. And that's when people feel like they can begin to take some risks. You can't ask people to do different, more radical kinds of things if you can't back them up. You know, they've got to have backing, because it's too risky. It's too weird. It's, you know, it's hard. And I'm deeply sympathetic to that. That's why I spend a lot of time trying to support people to do weird, more playful, more, you know, life-engaging things. And that's, to me, that really is the joy of people beginning to see people create something new that they didn't think they could, to have conversations they didn't think they could have, to share emotions they didn't think they could share, and do it together, often with, if you will, strangers.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
My guest on the D Word podcast this week is Mary Fridley from Reimagining Dementia.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's all about getting that message out there, isn't it? Interestingly, here in the UK, we have a soap opera called Emmerdale Farm. And on that, there have been two portrayals of cognitive one of dementia, which was very dark and gloomy, and currently they've got one of Parkinson's, which actually shows the gentleman still going out and playing golf. And I looked at those two portrayals, and I thought that kind of sums it up at the moment, the way that things stand.
Isn't it? I agree. Isn't it funny? I mean, I hadn't thought much about this. Isn't it funny that, and again, I'm not a big fan of, like, I was just reading an obituary of somebody who died of cancer. And of course, there's the obligatory, they had a long battle, you know, that's invariably, I don't know, I guess it's a, and again, I'm all for people fighting to live. So I'm not, but the kind of war language has always bothered me, but because I just don't think we're that much in control of things. However, it's interesting to me that if you do use war language and fighting, why don't we use that same language with dementia? You never hear people going, oh, we're going to battle through this together. We're going to see it through. We're going to. No, it's a, and I was struck by what you were saying about the gentleman with Parkinson's, you know, that being related to very differently. I mean, the throwing up of one hand and the abandonment is stark. And I think we as a, and I'm, I don't mean this moralistically or I'm not chastising anyone, but we could do a lot better and we don't. And I think, and I take responsibility for that. I mean, some people might say, oh, well, you're very, yeah, I am. And I try to put my activism where my heart is. However, I think we just have to do better. It's, we know how to do some of these things. But for some reason, the tragedy narrative that has so surrounded dementia is, you know, I think we're just going to have to keep chipping away at it. And I think we are, even in things like popular culture. And I mean, it's funny, I saw a movie, Memory, with Peter Sarsgaard. It came out earlier this year. And I'm not going to review the movie, but people can have their own opinions about the movie. I thought it was generally good. However, what I actually found kind of refreshing is that he lives, and his character lives with early stage dementia. But the movie was about a lot of things, including a relationship he was trying to develop with someone. But it was him living with dementia doing all those things. Hmm. It wasn't, oh, let's now look at the guy living with dementia and all of his. And, it, you know, and he got pushed back and it, all the prejudice. But the point of the movie wasn't, it was, okay, we're going to show him living his life and trying to, and continuing to do, and making mistakes and falling down, being a jerk and all the things we can all be. He was living his life. And to me, that's kind of what it's about, is seeing if we can just do better at helping all of us live better, to grow and to be far more emotionally giving and intimate and playful.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it, as time is running out on us a bit, okay, Mary. And I think, you know, what you said is the D word should be for do. And I think hopefully, you know, that will continue. You with Reimagining Dementia, the Creative Coalition, I hope everybody goes to look at the website and
just a little bit
think about it.
Yes. Well, we welcome everyone. Becoming a member is free. Your level of involvement is up to you. It takes a second. I mean, we would love, and if folks want to be in touch with me, they can do so through the coalition.
Well, Mary, it's been a pleasure. I'm sure we will get a chance to talk again. I'd love to have you back on the show. Thanks for
having me. Oh, I would love to. Please, thank you, and you have a lovely day.
Many thanks to Mary, and I'm sure we'll catch up again on the podcast in the future. Do take a look at the website www.reimaginingdementia.com. Well, that's all we have time for this time. Hope you've enjoyed it, and you'll join me again soon for some more dementia talk here on the D Word Podcast.